Well, it's that time once again, and so here we go with our second lecture for Music 112A, online version in the era of coronavirus. Well, thanks for your homework submissions from last time, and we'll get to that next time. Sorry, no sacrificial lambing will take place during these online versions. Okay, today we're going to start with a new feature. If you look on your Music 112A online homepage, there's a new link on there to in-class analysis examples. So find that link and click on that, and we're going to do a little in-class analysis using non-dominant seventh chords. Take a moment to open that. And you'll notice that you should see a Bach example, and then a Corelli example, and then a Mendelssohn example. We're going to work through those three right now. In each example, your task is to try to find a predominant non-dominant seventh chord. So a non-dominant seventh chord that functions as a predominant. So look for the dominant, probably towards the end of the phrase. Then you'll find just before that would be the logical place for a predominant. And if it's a seventh chord, probably a 2-7 or a 2-6-5. Those are the most common ones. We talked about 4-7 also last time. Look for those. Once you've found the predominant, non-dominant seventh chord, look for its seventh. So remember, spell it up from the root, root, third, fifth, seventh. See if that note is prepared in the same voice on the chord before. So we want to see if the seventh of the predominant seventh chord is prepared, and then also we want to see if it's resolved, should be resolved down a step. And then if the dominant chord, and I think in two of the three cases here, the dominant of these phrases will be a dominant seventh. So we might want to look to see if the seventh of the 5-7, in addition to the seventh of the 2-7, is also prepared as a common tone and resolved down by step. You might want to take a look right now at each of those examples on your own and pause this recording. Okay, we're back. So let's take a look at the first example from the Bach chorale. It sounds like this. If you've already looked that over and analyzed it, then go ahead. If not, why don't you pause the recording and see if you can find your non-dominant seventh chord that functions as a predominant, and look for the preparation and resolution of sevenths. For those of you that have already done this, we're going ahead. So this one is in the key of B flat. First chord in the last measure. C in the bass, and then we can spell that C, E flat, G, B flat. So that's your 2-7 chord. We're in the key of B flat. Scale degree 2 is C. We make a seventh chord built on C, C, E flat, G, B flat, the actual voicing used, which proceeds to a 5-7. Remember that E flat is holding over during its half note duration. And finally ending on 1. One thing that might help on these examples is if you can remember that on any 2-7 chord, so let's say we're in the key of B flat, we got 2 is C, C, E, G, B flat. Notice that the seventh of the 2-7 chord is scale degree 1, the tonic of the key you're in. B flat in this case. And that'll be true in any key. The seventh of the 2-7 chord will be scale degree 1. So that might help. All right, let's analyze this a little more carefully now. So our 2-7, that's that last measure. 2-7 chord, which voice has the seventh? Scale degree 1, the seventh of the 2-7, that is the alto voice. And notice that it's prepared. There's a B flat in the previous chord, which is a 1-6 chord. Same note, same voice, so nice preparation, Bach. Good job, buddy. And then resolves down by step. Meanwhile, the E flat, which is the third of the 2-7, becomes the seventh of the 5-7. So it is again prepared by virtue of the fact that you have the half note is the preparation, and then sing where that's supposed to resolve. And of course, there it goes. So that was example A. All right, moving on to example B. Stop for a second and look it over if you've not already done that. Okay, example B, Corelli. I'm just going to play the lower grand staff, the piano parts. C major, there you go. Okay, key of C major. 1-6-4-5-4-6-5-6-5-1. Okay. Okay, here's where all the action is. This is the last chord in the second to last measure. And the last measure. Downbeat of the last measure, the chord with the F in the bass. What Roman numeral did you get for that? 2-6-5. There it is. 2-6-5. Moving to a kind of a strange chord. Looks like it's going to be a cadential 6-4. And then sort of resolves abnormally. We'll have to talk to Corelli about that next time I have a seance and calling back composers from the dead. We'll say, hey, Archangelo, buddy, what were you doing on that cadence? In any case, we're not going to concern ourselves with that ill-fated cadential 6-4 thing, but look on the downbeat of that last measure, F in the bass, and beautifully done 2-6-5 chord. The root of the chord is D. The chord is spelled D, F, A, C. F is the bass note, the third of the chord. So it's a 2-6-5 chord. Notice that in this piano part, the lower grand staff, a complete chord. Third there, and then root, fifth, and seventh above that, the way we like to see it done. 2-6-5. What is the seventh of that chord? You remembered scale degree 1, 2-6-5. The seventh, in this case C, will be scale degree 1, the key that you're in. Okay? So C is the seventh. Notice how it's beautifully prepared in the soprano voice there. There's your 1-6, the second to or the last chord in the second to last measure. 1-6, 2-6-5. And where do we want that to resolve? Down by step. And it finally does when we get to that B leading tone and then on to the resolution. That's a real weird one with that ill-fated cadential 6-4 setup that just doesn't go where it's supposed to go. So never mind. Onward. Example C, Mendelssohn. Look it over. Find the predominant seventh chord, the non-dominant seventh chord, and check out the seventh on that for preparation and resolution. Go ahead and look that over. And here we go. Oh, sorry about that. Well, isn't that lovely? Mendelssohn's Song Without Words. Key of, you got it, E flat major. 1/6. A little bit of a trick here. That G up top with the sforzando on it is actually an appoggiatura. It's not part of the chord. Once it comes down to the F, now you have. That's right. 2-7 in the key of E flat. A 2-7. To 5-7. And then 1. So that G is effectively the ninth on that chord. Beautifully done. Kind of jazzy even. It's kind of a bebop treatment in slow motion. Anyway. A lot of interesting embellishing tones here that you can take a look at and discuss with your TA, maybe, if you'd like. Okay, so anyway, the third measure is taken up by the 2-7 chord. The seventh of the 2-7 is E flat. Key of E flat. Seventh of the 2-7 is E flat, and it is prepared. Here's the second measure, left hand only. That top note, E flat. There's now the seventh. That's going to come down by step to D. Also of interest, the 7th on the 5-7 chord would be the A-flat, kind of embedded in that thick voicing there. And that, in fact, was prepared. 3rd of the 2-7 chord becomes the 7th of the 5-7. And then it's transferred to the A-flat, the very last note in the measure. So that note transferred up there and resolves down to the 3rd of the 1. All right, now we're going to discuss embedding the phrase model. This is on page 329 of the textbook, embedding the phrase model. This is a kind of an interesting situation where you have a smaller version of something inside a larger version of that same thing. Usually on this day in class, I bring in my, well, you know those Russian nesting dolls, actually called a matryoshka in the Russian language, where you have, you take it apart and you see a smaller version of the same one, and you take that one apart and there's an even smaller version all the way down to a real tiny version. So the same form embedded in different sizes within each one. And in music, we often find that on different time scales. So we have the same type of structure embedded in a shorter version, embedded within the longer one. That may not make sense, but it will after we look at this example. So Let's look at example 12.5 there, where it says cadential and non-cadential phrase models. I'm going to play this for you. So if we look at that as a phrase, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 bar phrase, obviously the cadence is the last two chords with 5-1 scale degree 5 to scale degree 1 in the bass and the leading tone going up to tonic up above. Before that 5-1 is a 2 diminished 6 chord. There's your predominant. The first four bars of this phrase are a tonic expansion. If we look at the bass line, we can see how we just have some inverted chords that are basically involved with expanding the tonic G up to B flat, and then C as an upper neighbor to the B flat, and then finally back down to G. So if you look at the second level analysis down below the example, see the T with a long horizontal line all the way through those first four bars. So we have a tonic expansion, back to the one that we started on, and then predominant, dominant, tonic. So that's pretty standard stuff there at the end. What's interesting here, and we're going to find this increasingly as we fine-tune our analytical apparatus, is that what's interesting here is that you have on a shorter time scale a chord progression that could also be a T, P, D, D, T, which after all is the phrase model, T, P, D, D, T. So if we look at the opening chord, 1, followed by 1-6, those are tonic variety chords. 2 diminished 6 in the second bar. 2 diminished 6 often functions as a predominant, but here it goes to 5-4-2. The bass staying there. And then to 1-6. So if we look at the roots, 2-5-1, that sure sounds like PDDT to me. But it's not considered the second level PDDT because of the inversions, 2 diminished 6 to 5-4-2 to 1-6. We don't get that motion of a perfect fifth that I've been yelling and screaming about all term as marking off a cadence. But on a smaller time level, we do have 1, 2 diminished 6, 5, 4, 2, 1, 6. And we can think of that as a phrase model, T, P, D, D, T, that's embedded within the larger phrase model that occupies the whole phrase. So look at the blue shaded square just under the very short paragraph under where the heading of this section embedding the phrase model is. And it says embedded phrase model, and then in quotes, mini model. So we have the smaller scale TPDDT that is itself the tonic expansion of the main T of the TPDDT that is the whole phrase. Think about that. I'm going to stop the recording now and give you a chance to think about that a little bit. So you have two different chord progressions that could use the functions T, P, D, D, T, but they take up different time spans. The thing to remember is the just about the last thing at the bottom of the page, it says a second level analysis has just one overall T, P, D, D, T. So you'll notice with this example 12.5, the second level, you see a long tonic expansion and then the PDDT using the root position 5 to root position 1. But then we have on a smaller scale, time scale, that is, the TPDDT, the mini version of it that's embedded within it. So that's why we call this an embedded phrase model. A phrase model, TPDDT, but embedded within a larger version of TPDDT. The final topic for today's lecture is contrapuntal cadences. This can be found starting on page 332 of the late text, contrapuntal cadences. So, we've said for a while that in order to have a cadence, I'll do this in C major, in order to have a cadence, you want to have a root position 5 to a root position 1. And if you have your text, I didn't reproduce this for the online version, sorry. And I can't get into my office to get this and scan it for you because we're on lockdown. But if you go back to page 172, if you happen to have your textbook, that's where we first introduced cadences. And on there, amidst the perfect authentic cadences and the imperfect authentic cadences and the half cadences, is something called contrapuntal cadence. You'll notice if you're looking at that, it's letter E and letter F. Contrapuntal cadence is where you have something where you say, gee, this has to be the cadence. Why? Because it's so obviously the end of a phrase. Maybe the motion stops, there's a fermata, or it's the end of a section, or you say, that has to be the end of something. We gotta call that a cadence. But rather than 5-1 in the bass, you might have T to do in the bass, or re to do in the bass. Let's look at Leitz's paragraph here. He says, structural cadences involve root position dominant and tonic harmonies. That's how I've been saying over and over again. Root position dominant to root position tonic. Then he goes on and says, however, composers occasionally close phrases using inverted dominant and tonic harmonies, often in order to save the powerful root position 5 until a more dramatic and final sounding cadence is required. So you might have the close of an intermediate section, not the very, very end of an entire piece, closing on something that you say, gee, that's got to be an ending. We got to call that a cadence, and yet it's not root position 1 to root position 5. And so then Leitz goes on to say, cadences in which either the dominant or the tonic, or sometimes both, are inverted, that is to say, not in root position, cadences in which either the dominant or the tonic are inverted are called contrapuntal cadences. It has to do with counterpoint. If you had two voices moving like that, or the lower voice moving D, C, the top voice B up to C. If you remember, that's the type of cadence we used in modal counterpoint when we did species counterpoint, where we didn't have a 5-1 motion in the bass. We talked about that in terms of counterpoint, and that's where this term contrapuntal cadence comes from. So let's look at example C on the next page, page 333, example 12.8C. I'm going to play this and note that the vocal part, I'm certainly not going to sing for you, notice that the vocal part is the same as the piano part, left hand. Exactly the same. And if you look at the lyrics, it's talking about, it says, a crow followed me out of the town. Supposedly the fact that the vocal part and the piano part are in unison is representing the crow following the narrator. minor. I'm gonna block the chords here. Now look at the last measure. So we don't know exactly what comes after that because it's just an excerpt, but let's stipulate, as the lawyers say, let's just establish as a fact that that is the end of a phrase. Well, if that's the end of a phrase, we sure don't have root position 5 to root position 1. That would be E to D, one of those two ways. Instead, we have B, a 7 diminished 6 chord. B in the bass, moving to A. So either it's not a cadence, and you say, ah, that's just a tonic expansion, or you say, that is a cadence. I have to say it's a cadence because we stipulated to that fact. If that is a cadence, but it's not a root position 5 to a root position 1, that's the kind of cadence we would call a contrapuntal cadence. Now, after that explanation, here's something that's really interesting. Up above example 12.8, in the final paragraph, or it's actually the first indented paragraph at the top of the page, he says, it is also possible to view this four-measure excerpt as merely a tonic expansion, and therefore not a phrase, since there's no strong root position harmonic motion from T through D. Even such apparently simple decisions as whether a musical unit is a phrase or not can often become a matter of interpretation. And you may notice that in my handwriting next to that, I've scanned from my personal copy for you here, I wrote that music is an art, not a science. And so sometimes even a very simple decision, is this a phrase or is this not a phrase? Is it just a tonic expansion or is it a phrase? If it's a phrase, there will be a cadence. If it's just a tonic expansion, there may not be a cadence. Those decisions sometimes can provoke furious battles between different theorists who have different points of view. For me, I usually am willing to just say, well, the composer left it ambiguous as to whether or not it was a phrase, whether or not it was a cadence. And sometimes that deliberate ambiguity is, in my opinion, deliberately confusing so that you can make up your mind according to whatever criteria you provide. You think it sounds final sounding, then it's a contrapuntal cadence. If you think it sounds incomplete sounding, you might say, no, that's just a tonic expansion. I'm going to wait till later to really make a dramatic cadence. And that is the kind of analysis that can really help inform your interpretation as a performer. That's really the bottom line. The music is an art, and different performers can have different interpretations. So I hope you enjoyed this version of Music Theory Online. And there is no homework for next time. So enjoy your time off wherever you happen to be. Hey, feel free to send me some notes saying where you are, what you're doing. And it's always great to hear from you. I'm going to sign off now, and we'll pick this up next Tuesday with another interesting and exciting version of Music 112 Online.